This is Ron Orl, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited today to be welcoming back to the podcast Lawrence Elbaum, partner at Vinson & Elkins in New York. Elbaum co-heads V&E's shareholder activism practice, advising companies targeted by activist investors. He's here to talk to us a bit about how the market volatility may be impacting M&A and activist investors and their campaigns, which often, let's face it, feature M&A components, and a bit about how he thinks the Twitter Elon Musk saga might play out in Delaware Chancery Court, which is where it's heading. Thanks, Lawrence, for taking the time.
Thank you, Ron, for having us. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you, as always.
Okay, super. So I found that even when they don't admit it, M&A is an important goal for activists. Obviously a lot publicly pushed for deals, as we saw McCallum did at Kohl's. Was not successful there. But, I wanted to get your thoughts about, Lawrence, about how important deals are to activists. By deals, I'm talking about pushing for divestiture, pressing for sale of the business, or blocking existing transactions, or pushing for higher offers. And I wanted to see if you could talk about in the context of the current market conditions. And, we're seeing, I believe, that M&A market may be cooling down a bit due to all these macroeconomic factors, inflation, supply chain issues, energy prices, Russia's Ukraine war. I don't know. I'm just trying to get a sense of what impact this might have on activists. I guess, one, do you agree that M&A is an important component for activists, a lot of activist campaigns, even if they don't admit it? And two, what will the current macroeconomic conditions mean for activists that push for M&A? Will we see more operational activists, for example?
Great questions. Happy to try to address them. On the topic of are activists being intellectually honest if they're saying M&A is not important to them, I do not think they're being intellectually honest. It's not important to them. I would say that shareholders, particularly hedge funds that have investors in their own funds, are going to be very hard pressed to say that M&A is not important to them because they have an obligation to their LPs to make them money.
Right.
Even if they don't have an obligation to their LPs to make them money, if they want to get other LPs to invest in the future, they need to make money. So I think M&A is definitely on the minds of activists that are intellectually dishonest about their M&A intentions. I don't think that serves them well. I think that it behooves them to be above board about what their intentions are, whether that's public or private in their dealings with the company and other shareholders. M&A is still a component of virtually every single activism campaign that we're defending. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It's either you should sell and sell immediately.
Right. It's
you should be consolidating. That's happening a lot now.
By consolidating, you mean like, the company should be making acquisitions. It's it needs to make bolt-on other types of acquisitions.
Exactly. Instead of being acquired and consolidated into a peer, you should be consolidating your peers because you're the leader. Mm-hmm. There's also M&A insofar as there's breakup M&A. There's your company has non-core assets, spin them out or sell them or whatever. So we see a lot of that. And then there also is, the bumpetrage type of M&A or the M&A against a deal. And we're seeing that in the airline space right now, most notably. So it's all over the place.
It's M&A. By airline, you're talking about the Spirit, Frontier, JetBlue, three-way love-hate triangle.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And yeah, those are also very interesting campaigns. What's actually interesting about those campaigns, we saw it a few times last year as well, when a board has said that they've determined that they can no longer unlock value anymore for shareholders, they've decided that a sale at $10 is the best value they can unlock for shareholders. When shareholders vote that down, that makes every single director on that board vulnerable, right? Because the shareholders are saying you didn't in our opinion, maximize value. We voted the deal down. That makes all those directors vulnerable in terms of their board seats and their longevity of the company. Same thing with management. Now, obviously, in the case of the love triangle that you just mentioned, there is another interloper there, and the board at Spirit may just be, you know, doing everything they need to do under their contract with Frontier. Say that they tried the best they could to get the vote done, and then they may end up going on several dates and maybe even going home with JetBlue at the end of the day. I don't know. If you look at what happened, I think it was Willis Towers Watson.
Uh-huh.
They were supposed to merge with Aon earlier this year. You saw how quickly that merger broke up. Now, that was because of antitrust headwinds, I believe.
Right.
But you saw how quickly, I think Starboard, maybe Elliott too.
That's right.
Were in the shareholder base, rumored for a long time. And then there was a board shakeup once the deal fell through. Right.
That's so, right. That's right. There was, I believe, a settlement with Elliott or either that or Starboard. I can't remember which one. Yeah.
Correct. Correct.
Just and by the way, just for our listeners, the there are, you know, the antitrust issues could arise with the JetBlue deal if it does strike a deal with Spirit. I mean, that's one of the reasons why they're going with Frontier. So they may end up going home with JetBlue, but then be spurned at the altar or something down the road. So anyways, yeah, I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, no, look, I was going to say, just in terms of the economic climate, there are a lot of interesting dynamics going on. So one dynamic is, as stock prices are dropping, and actually we're going to, I haven't actually looked at the charts, but we're, I think, approaching some of the numbers that we were seeing during the COVID sell-off back in, you know, March, April, May of 20. It's probably not as bad, but there's geopolitical and then there's macro micro economic in the US because of inflation and other conditions. I think that that creates a very ripe environment for M&A. We mentioned consolidation earlier. There's the notion of a company being the last man standing in a particular industry. I think we're really going to see that in SPACs. There are so many, I'll call them electric mobility SPACs, for instance, that have gone public, or companies that have gone public through SPACs that are in the electric mobility space, where they're trading, you know, at 80% below their IPO price or their niche price. And I think there's going to be a lot of consolidation there because some of these companies have real IP, have real businesses. They're trading well below the cash on their balance sheet. And I believe that there will be consolidation in that space. There could be insolvencies in that space at the other end of the spectrum too. But I think there's going to be, consolidation. And we've started to see proxy fights. We've been involved in a few. We were involved in the first proxy fight defense at a de-SPAC'd company, which was last year at Velodyne Lidar against the founders. So I think we're going to see more of that. So the SPAC saga is not over yet. It's just it's transforming into another phase of the SPAC story. I think that the interesting thing is for the companies where sale themes were part of the proxy fights this year. So most notably, Kohl's, I think Hasbro, there was a spin theme, I believe.
Right. No, definitely. Breakup. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are others, but, you know, Kohl's most notably. Look, boards don't have crystal balls. So the board did not know that the stock would be where it's at right now when they were making very strong statements about how thorough their process was and how great they were proceeding as fiduciaries. But I think the issue is for companies like that, that may have declined to do a deal at prices that made a lot of sense looking in hindsight, they're going to have to do a really good job explaining to shareholders next year how those deals were not actionable. Yeah, we got someone came in at $25. I know the stock's at 10 now, but these deals were not actionable. And we ran them down and there was no deal at the end of the day. What happens is, though, is, you know, companies, you know, are able in peacetime there. It's a lot easier for them to handle those types of negotiations and explain themselves later on. When you have a situation like Kohl's, where the company was very public about, you know, why it should win the proxy fight and why the activist candidates shouldn't be in the boardroom. They made a lot of promises about the business, about the process they were running, about the path forward on their strategic plan. And it remains to be seen whether those promises will be fulfilled year over year. And that makes the directors very vulnerable. I'm surprised that the activist there has not come out demanding board seats now, with the narrative that give us our board seats now, we're definitely going to get them next year. Don't waste shareholder time and money, you know, building barriers. I would hope the board is thinking about exactly that and, you know, how they're going to get the right narrative out there next year, given, you know, all these macro and micro headwinds. It's a fascinating situation. When we work with boards and management teams, we're very careful about the knee-jerk reaction is to overpromise and gild the lily and paint a rosy picture. We're very focused on playing it right down the middle, zealously, but being intellectually honest with our shareholders, because we're always thinking about year two, year three, year four, year five, because when way too many times we have seen boards become extremely vulnerable after crushing an activist in year one. We've seen them become incredibly vulnerable years two through five, and where they lose control or they're sold. Yes, so that's why I'm watching what happens with these issuers next year with interest. And it's frankly, a lot of the proxy fights we defended this year, you know, depending on what league table you look at, it's somewhere between 10 and 15 proxy fights, actual proxy fights with nominations that we defended this year. The vast majority of them settled because we focused our boards on beyond year one, year two, year three, year four, and how to help them chart a course to give themselves and management as much runway as possible.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because the so I've been obviously following the proxy fight and auction at Kohl's very closely. That the activist there is kind of a retail focused activist, McCallum John Duskin. And, you know, they lost this proxy fight and then they had the auction and it failed. And it was interesting. I was speaking to a real estate expert yesterday that focused a lot on activism. And, you know, there was a lot of speculation that for the buyers to be able to buy Kohl's, they would sell and lease back the real estate or a large chunk of the real estate to help sign the equity check, you know, because the real estate was worth in one estimate, $7 billion. You know, I don't know, unlikely that they would sell all the real estate in one swoop. But, you know, there were potential buyers, at least one buyer out there for the real estate. But you wonder whether they're going to have to do some sort of strategic action based on what you're telling me, Lawrence. I'm wondering whether they're going to have to do some sale leaseback of the real estate. Because these real estate experts I spoke to yesterday, they had suggested that, you know, I thought, oh, maybe this is all slowing down because of the cooling market. But they think retailers will continue to struggle. And they're going to need to do something to prop the share price up. And one of the things they can do is sell and lease back real estate. And Kohl's has a lot of real estate. So, but that's interesting. So you think we might see another proxy fight next year?
I think, yeah. Or someone's going to scoop them up really cheap. I mean, look, the buyer that ended up being the last man standing in the Kohl's process, I had no doubt that transaction would not get consummated. I would have bet the entire farm that was absolutely a pipe dream deal that was put together at the end there. And I have to tell you, I mean, the publicity around that price and the timing of Vintage Capital's bid.
That was that Brian Kahn with the, and it was his franchise group.
The timing of that and the drop in price after the shareholder vote, I mean, the shareholders just must be enraged there. And if I was the company, I'd be spending a lot of time in the off season cooling the jets of my shareholders because they must be livid.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. We don't have a lot of time. So I wanted to talk about Twitter, which is, I think the most interesting kind of activist slash deal story to ever land, I think, or at least since I've been following Delaware Chancery Court. And I wanted, Lawrence, to put on your litigation hat for a few minutes here, because I know you have a lot of good experience understanding how litigation impacts deals and activism and things like that. So I guess the big question is, you know, now that we know that the soap opera like battle for Twitter is heading to the Delaware Court of Chancery, you know, we heard this week that the Twitter they filed a suit to compel Elon Musk to close his $44 billion, $54.20 a share deal. And I guess the first question is, you know, I've been receiving a lot of people that don't cover, you know, lawsuits or litigation. I've been giving kind of very different opinions on this, how long this might take. And my suspicion is that if they continue to push for Musk to consummate the deal, which is the main part of the lawsuit, this is something that the Delaware Chancery Court will take very seriously and try to get a result soon, right? Because there's a lot at stake, you know, the employees, the shareholders, everybody's wanting to know whether he's going to do this deal or not. So aren't they going to try to resolve this quickly, or do you think it's going to take a while?
It has to take a while. So look, if it actually goes to hearing and a trial, the result will be appealed.
All right. Delaware Supreme Court.
So I think it's going to go on for a while. I think both sides have amassed terrific advisor teams to set it up so that this goes on for a while. And, you know, it's kind of like an indomitable force colliding with an immovable object at this point. That's not as good as my Voltron reference that I gave you the other day. But I think they're definitely going to be some significant court skirmishes here. At the end of the day, I think that Elon Musk still wants the business, but just wants to pay less for it and is using the tool of termination that would draw litigation as a business strategy to get a price that he's more comfortable with for the asset. Right now, he probably believes, correctly so, that he is the market for this asset and has pricing power. It remains to be seen whether or not the agreement will hold up in his favor in court. I have to tell you that it's kind of like the way a lot of folks are buying residential real estate. You know, since the pandemic started, folks have been driving to the suburbs and sometimes not even coming to the suburbs, but they've been buying homes as is, where is, sight unseen, cash. That's kind of what this deal is here. And it's tough on paper to walk away from. You know, there may be some compelling argument about, you know, providing information in good faith to continue to consummate the transaction, but it's a light agreement from a buyer protection perspective, in my view. And I think the company is going to press on that. But at the end of the day, would the company close a deal at a 15% discount, given where the market headwinds are right now? Isn't that a good question? What would you do if you were the board?
Yeah, I'd probably take that deal.
I would bet dollars to donuts Musk employing the right strategy here could get this asset quickly and cheaper, and he'll pocket a few shekels in the process.
So yeah, no, it's interesting because, okay, so let's say the litigation, you know, it's hard to get into Musk's brain. I'm with you on this idea that he wants to use this as leverage to negotiate a lower price. And he's bringing up this issue of spam and fake accounts and his letter. It seems like he's focusing his defense on that Twitter just didn't provide him with sufficient data information on the number of fake and spam accounts, which are necessary to determine how many daily active users can be targeted with advertising. And, you know, on one level, it seems like a legitimate complaint if he's, you know, not able to get this data. But how is this going to play out in court? I can't imagine like the Delaware Chancery Court judge is going to go look at this. They call it a fire hose, which is the unfiltered stream of tweets and the data about them, the location, username, information, you know, millions and millions of these. Each side is going to bring up an expert that kind of looked at the data, right? And they're going to talk about it. I'm just trying to think, how do you think this will look like in the court, assuming it's not, you know, settled earlier?
Yeah, I think both sides are going to proffer many experts. They're going to make this issue, on Musk's side, he's going to make it seem as material and complex and going to the core of the asset that he's buying. And he's going to have, you know, an expert for every single facet possible to show that this is material. It's central to the deal, and the company, you know, behaved unreasonably. And on the flip side, the company is going to proffer numerous experts, probably saying our bots are publicly known that there are bots, and, you know, an agreement is an agreement is an agreement. This is a simple agreement. It's clear and unambiguous. Interpret it using the four corners approach. But they probably will have to proffer some experts to rebut the arguments that Musk's going to be making about users and the ability to target them, who are real users and who are illusory users. And it's going to get extremely complex and cavernous.
Yeah, no, I think that one of the interesting things is we'll learn a lot about, you know, the lead up to the deal in through discovery and in the trial, if it does go to trial. I was just covering a hearing that was all about this Aerojet Rocketdyne failed effort to sell itself to Lockheed Martin. And we learned so much about stuff that we never would have learned if it hadn't gone to trial. So as a reporter, it'll be really interesting to see the buildup to this and what we learn about it in the trial. But I got to ask one more question, a couple more questions about the Twitter situation. What happens if the Delaware, you know, like, well, I've been reading sell-side analyst reports suggesting that, you know, Twitter has the upper hand here. You know, who knows if that's true, but what happens if the Delaware court orders Musk to complete the deal and he refused? And, you know, I've been hearing that he could be held in contempt of court, but I'm trying, what does that mean, being held in contempt of court? David Faber of CNBC suggested that he could get jail time, but I don't know. I feel like there would be fines, or what would happen if he was failed to complete the deal and he was ordered to complete the deal and he refused?
It's really hard for me to see Elon Musk or anyone refusing to close a deal ending up in jail.
That's
right. That seems extra. I mean, you know, it depends, right? Is Elon Musk refusing, but also, you know, reenacting the end of Scarface with Al Pacino? Because then that might be befitting of jail. But, you know, I have to say it's hard for me to see that. Look, it could be a court order involving damages, involving compelling the deal to close, involving the payment of interest. But it's really hard for me to see that happening. I mean, you see related party transactions that are not disclosed, self-dealing, the duty of loyalty being violated in cases under Delaware law. And you don't see directors and officers and other participants, investors going to jail because of the results. There are other equitable remedies that I think are more likely in jail.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. Okay, time for one more question. And it kind of relates to the loss a little bit. I mean, it was brought up in the Twitter lawsuit. And that is, you know, Musk has had lots of problems with his disclosures related to his investment in Twitter. For example, his original 13G filed on April 4th was late, and it was a passive disclosure of this massive Twitter position. And then it was later found through the merger proxy that he had previously talked about director positions and even a possible bid prior to that. So most recently, the SEC on Thursday released a June comment letter where they asked him additional questions about a May tweet. I know this is kind of ancient history, but I'm sure you remember that in May, Musk tweeted that this deal cannot move forward unless CEO Parag Agarwal showed proof about low spam accounts. And then the SEC asked him and said, well, you know, you're wondering whether Musk was exercising a legal right to suspend completion of the merger when he said this deal cannot move forward. And that, therefore, why didn't he file an amended 13D to reflect this, quote, apparent material change? But yeah, I don't know. They were asking him questions. He responded, and, you know, they made it sound like it wasn't, you know, he wasn't trying to block the deal or cancel the deal at that point. Obviously, later on, he did decide to cancel the deal and then filed, you know, proper filings after that. But, you know, should he have filed an amended 13D when he tweeted? I guess maybe this leads to a broader question. He seems to tweet a lot about, you know, very aggressive tweets that you have to really follow those up with SEC filings, particularly if you have a deal on the table. No.
Yeah. Look. So first of all, Elon Musk has a long and rich history with a difference of opinion, I'll say, with the SEC over disclosure. Mm-hmm. And I think he and the SEC are going to be in a perpetual struggle over that. But he seems to successfully resolve these matters with the SEC. I think this argument is a complete red herring when it comes to his ability to buy the business, whether the agreement says he has to buy the business. Unless the company's trying to cook up some type of an argument that he never wanted to buy the business, he just wanted to, you know, increase the stock price and or just play a grand game of social media meets the public equities markets. But I think that, look, he'll resolve these things. But generally, when you're a 13D filer, which he ultimately was, your 13D item 4 disclosure about your intent, if it is not wide ranging and robust and, you know, covering a lot of detailed possibilities, and it's very generic and plain vanilla, just a generalized intent to influence the board or business, you go more specific than that, you've got to amend your 13D filing. The interesting thing is that the SEC wants investors to have timely, complete, and accurate information. And it's actually an interesting legal philosophical question where you have someone where ordinarily you'd have to amend your 13D and update your intent. But here, I would bet that almost everyone that's following his 13Ds are also following his tweets.
Absolutely.
Argument will be made like, look, this isn't the total mix of information that's out there, mm-hmm. right? It's not like he had this intent and sent a letter privately and then didn't publicize the letter on his 13D. He's letting the public know exactly what's on his mind at all times.
Yeah.
And if I were in the shoes of his advisors, I would be saying, like, this isn't a case of improper disclosures or incomplete disclosures. He's over disclosing. The kimono is constantly wide open.
Right.
And should he put in his 13D filings in bold and underline, this item 4 disclosure is qualified in its entirety by the entire universe of Elon Musk's tweets? Maybe he should do that.
File an amended 13D each time he tweeted something about, you know, controversial. Yeah. Like that.
Or maybe he can create a new 13D technology. You heard it first here, Ron.
Uh-huh. Okay.
New 13D technology that has a ticker in it that shows Musk's tweets real time so that there's no mistake about what he's saying. It seems to me like with someone that communicates so publicly, there's got to be a way to marry how rapid fire his public communications are with the 13D regulations. And that seems to me to be an easily addressable matter.
And in full disclosure, in Musk's defense, he did subsequently file that tweet, but not as an amended 13D, as a different kind of filing, which the SEC also seemed to be scratching his head about. So anyway. Okay, we are out of time. You've been listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast, and I've been speaking to Lawrence Elbaum of Vinson & Elkins. Thanks, Lawrence, for taking the time. We had really learned a lot, and it was a really interesting conversation.
Thank you. Take care.